Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The quest for synthetic humans. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International. Dolly the sheep was cloned in 1996, but no human being has ever been duplicated. Now there's the possibility of creating a human from scratch. Genetic scientists have already mapped the human genome, opening the possibility of eliminating disease. A Harvard geneticist is raising money to manufacture a human genome with the potential of creating a synthetic person who has no parents. We'll talk with him and others, including fellow scientists, who raise ethical and religious objections that he's going too far, too fast. Today's talking point, Russia's track and field team is banned from the Rio Olympics. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Creating synthetic humans sounds like science fiction, but genetic science has advanced so fast that the possibility is becoming a fact. We'll talk with the geneticist who's leading the way, and we'll hear about ethical and religious objections. Today's talking point, in an action without precedent in the history of the Olympics, Russia's track and field team has been barred from this summer's games in Rio. It's all about performance-enhancing drugs, and we'll talk with Dick Pound, the founding president of the World Anti-Doping Agency. First, this news update. After meeting with Saudi Arabia's deputy crown prince today in the Oval Office, President Obama had no public comment. Meantime, the White House has received a critical moment from 51 mid-level employees of the State Department asking increased military action against Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Karen DeYoung is a senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. And Karen, it's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Good to be here.
What are these people asking the president to do?
Well, you know, I think this stems from increasing concern everywhere in the administration and certainly around the world about the terrible humanitarian situation in Syria. More and more people dying, a ceasefire not holding. And certainly the State Department, within the State Department, Secretary Clinton, when she was in office, and Secretary Kerry have been in the forefront of urging a more aggressive policy against Assad. I think initially that was when this started a number of years ago, that was on a political basis to stop the civil war from escalating and get rid of Assad. More recently, it is focused a lot on this humanitarian situation. The White House, of course, has always been, President Obama himself, very much against any U.S. military posture against Assad. Of course, they're bombing the Islamic State in other parts of Syria, but they say they do not want to get involved in the civil war that's now been going on for 5 years, because it just wouldn't take the situation anywhere. President Obama has specifically said it would get bloodier, and no one can explain to me how that's going to make the situation better. Of course, now, again, this is something that particularly Secretary Kerry has been urging for some time, but now it's even more complicated than it was before because of Russian involvement and Russian aircraft operating on behalf of Assad. So you have several dozen, 51 State Department officials, not senior people, mostly mid-level people, many of them working in the Middle Eastern Bureau, saying, look, we can't let this go on. We have got to The only way there's going to be a negotiated settlement in the Civil War is if Assad sees in no uncertain terms that he's going to lose this war. So far, he has not seen that. On the contrary, he thinks now he's winning. And we, the United States, cannot let this go on, and we have a responsibility to use more aggressive military action, not troops on the ground, but air attacks and what they call standoff weapons, which can be cruise missiles, it can be long-range artillery, can be any one of a number of things that are essentially fired from far away.
So they're not calling for troops to be used in any way. Now, as I understand it, this comes from the dissent channel that exists within the State Department, something created during the Vietnam War?
Yes, this was, there were certainly, as the Vietnam War went on, there were increasing numbers of people in the government that were not happy with it. And in order to give them a private way to express their concerns, and I think more importantly, to put into their own protocols that there can be no reprisals or punishment of people who express alternative views as long as they go through these channels. They established this dissent channel. And
no, nothing private
anyone,
about this time, though. Here we are talking about it
someone,
on the radio.
Yes, someone leaked it. It was signed, as I said, by 51 people, turned over to the Office of Policy Planning, which is what the guidelines call for it to do, and on Tuesday, and awaiting Secretary Kerry to return from a trip overseas. He won't be back until later this evening, and at some point this week it got leaked.
Is it the sort of thing that might be picked up politically, do you think? It would seem to me it's rich for Donald Trump to take advantage of it.
Well, not only Donald Trump, and really not primarily Donald Trump. You know, Hillary Clinton has been in the forefront of as a candidate as of urging more aggressive U.S. action, establishment of a U.S. protected safe zone in Syria. Certainly, many Republicans and more than a few Democrats have said they would like a more aggressive posture. Their calls range from air attacks, such as were called for in this memo, and some have even called, Senator John McCain has called for putting troops in on the ground.
Okay, well, we will see. I take it the White House hasn't responded to this as yet, nor has the State Department officially,
no,
even though it is within the State Department.
Yeah, Kerry said this morning that he had not had a chance to sit down and read the whole thing, that he would do that, that he welcomed it, that this was a time-honored and legal tradition at the State Department. These people are certainly within their rights.
Karen DeYoung with The Washington Post. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
In a moment, the quest for synthetic humans on To The Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To The Point. Since Dolly the sheep was cloned 20 years ago, genetic science has advanced at dizzying speed. DNA has become a commercial product, and it's creating the prospect of eliminating disease. Recently, word leaked of a secretive project at Harvard where scientists are raising money to create the first synthetic human genome. Antonio Regalado is senior editor for biomedicine at the MIT Technology Review. Thanks so much for joining us on our program.
Hey, Warren. Great to be here.
Tell us, if you will, what this means when you say creating a synthetic human genome.
Okay. Well, let's wind the clock back 13 years to the first human genome project, which wrapped up in 2003, and that was to read the human genetic code. It was to decipher all 3 billion letters. They're called nucleotides. That's basically the software that runs us, right? The genome. So now the proposal is, well, if we can read a genome, why can't we write one? And that's the idea, that in the lab, scientists would start to chemically synthesize a genome from scratch, put it in a cell, and boot it up.
There was some surprise when it was revealed that there is a project of this going forward at Harvard.
We'll have to hear from the other guests about how far advanced the project is. Certainly the way it came out, I don't think was the way the organizers intended. They had a private meeting. They were trying to organize kind of consensus around a statement about the project's intentions in order to raise funding, and word leaked of that, and so it became a kind of a secret meeting is basically how it was interpreted.
Before we go forward, though, you said this is an enormously complex process, 3 billion letters involved. Simpler organisms have 10,000. We have a lot more. So the scale of this project then would be enormous.
It would be enormous. Of course, the genome, it's in a cell. It is itself very tiny, but constructing DNA is a difficult process that has been improving, but not quite as fast as people would like. You can order online a gene with maybe 10,000 DNA letters, but you're right. Once you're talking about 3 billion letters, the cost of producing that much DNA and just the sheer complexity of sort of patching it together to work as a genome is pretty daunting.
When the word leaked, there were a number of concerns expressed, including the fact that many of those involved, I take it, in the project are business people.
Right. There's definitely a commercial angle here. First of all, there's the companies that make DNA. They're hoping to improve that technology and really kind of create new markets for DNA. There's also a software company involved, Autodesk, kind of a mid-sized software company that does CAD software for designing. And so clearly their idea is in the future, people are going to go on a computer and they're going to design genomes of bacteria, maybe of people, and they might use their software.
Would there be a market for the human genome?
I think that that is an open question. Synthesizing a complete human genome is a sort of fascinating scientific project. I think one of the criticisms of the idea is that we don't yet know what a synthetic human genome really would be for, other than maybe making synthetic people.
Antonio Regalado, once again, at the MIT Technological Review. Let us talk with the person who has the most to say about this, knows the most about it, is leading the project at Harvard, George Church. He is a professor of genetics at the Harvard Medical School, one of the organizers of the Synthetic Human Genome Project. Dr. Church, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
You have been quoted as saying, and I believe you said in your book, Regenesis, How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves, that we ought to try to create people with fabricated genomes. What do you mean by that? How long would it take?
Right. So just to be clear on the project, it's about creating human cells, But to answer that question, we are already changing human genomes in living people. It's called gene therapy, and there are 2,200 gene therapies that are already in clinical trials, meaning that they are curing people and moving forward towards full FDA and EMA approval.
Okay. So what does that have to do with actually creating a person that would have no parents?
Well, not much. The project that initiated this conversation is about cells, which is much more constrained than gene therapy, which deals mostly with children and adults being modified, and then any change in the germline, whether it's even one base pair out of the 6 billion in the typical human, is already banned. There's a moratorium on it, at least until there is evidence that it is safe and effective, just like any other new medical therapy. So this project is not about germline, where even one base pair matters. It's not about gene therapy, where you could have fairly extensive changes in an adult or child. It's about cells. And if you'd like, I can give an example of the quote market for such a
sure.
synthetic genome. Yeah, so an example would be one. We've already demonstrated this in microbial systems that are used industrially, where you can, by changing enough of the genome, you can make it resistant to all viruses by changing the genetic code. if you could just scale that up from microbial to human, which isn't as big a scale up as you might think, then you could manufacture therapeutics as they are currently manufactured without risk of viral contamination. And this is a real risk because Genzyme, for example, had a 2-year interruption in its production of orphan drugs, which is very critical, and they were the sole source of some of these orphan drugs. So that would be one application, and then we're increasingly moving towards cell-based transplants and cell therapies, and you would like those cells that you're introducing into a human for therapeutic purposes to be resistant to viruses and cancer. So I think there is a real market, but there's also a very real scientific need for figuring out what all the variation that we're finding turning up in clinics it means.
All right. What about the question that this program is really about, and that is your statement and your progress, as I understand it, that we can ultimately and ought to create people out of fabricated genomes. How far along are we at that, and what's the purpose?
Yeah, I don't think that was the point of the project. It's not something that it's not a question that.
But
one
you said in your book that we should do it.
I didn't quite say that. I mean, I said that we could do. Certainly, gene therapy is changing the genome of whole human beings for pharmaceutical purposes, for therapeutic purposes. The book tended not to say should. It discussed possibilities, and you know, one of the obligations of us as bioethicists is to fully flesh out things far in advance, and that's why, you know, I think that when the topic of this particular meeting and this particular effort to make genomes less costly to synthesize them, it makes some sense to talk about things that might be very far down the road. But that is not the intention of the project.
Okay, as far as you are concerned, you didn't say should in the book, but do you think that this is inevitable and that we ought to, in fact, move in that direction?
I don't think anything's inevitable, and I think that in general the process is that we make pretty small incremental changes, which are then approved by IRBs and FDA, to make sure that they're safe and effective, and then if they are safe and effective, then we take the next step. And I think there are many steps between here, even in making one change in the just a simple change in the human germline, for example, eliminating a serious disease like Tay-Sachs in the human germline is something that's been debated at the National Academy level with multiple countries involved.
George Church, again, professor of genetics at the Harvard Medical School, one of the organizers of the Synthetic Human Genome Project. Laurie Zoloth is professor of religion and bioethics at Northwestern University. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You were one of those who, when word of the project, the meeting that we just heard described, leaked out, expressed some serious concerns about it. Tell us why.
Well, there's several things to think about when you think about what a human genome is. For the last several decades, we have tended to think of DNA as something very special, a special kind of internal map for each of us, the thing that makes us distinct. And we use that in common language, like, it's in my DNA to be kind, right? Because we think of our DNA as unique, not replicable, and the way we tend to make new DNA is we fall in love and we make children, right? So that's done out of love, and that's done out of faith, and that's within the narratives of a theological conversation in which new human persons are born out of love to a future that we have enormous hope for and faith in. When we talk about making that a synthetic process, when we talk about assembling DNA sequences in a lab and then using them with the possible goal of making new persons, then in fact we are talking about a theological question, not a scientific one. And that's why theologians and ordinary people and philosophers and PTA presidents and everyone has to think about this major shift in how we create DNA. And that's what got our attention. It's a it's a discussion that, while it may have some use far in the future, is not exactly how genetic medicine has been going. It's not a logical next step for how we think about the human genome. It may be a decade or more, say scholars of genetic medicine, before we can accurately read and understand what a human genome does. So the attempt to write one without fully understanding how it works and what's going on and how epigenetics works is an act of haste, I think, and it needs to be thought through very carefully and very publicly before we take that step. I'm on the recombinant DNA advisory committee called the RAC, and that's the board of people, scientists, physicians, pediatricians, and bioethicists from different fields, who look at every single gene therapy experiment, and they are all experimental at this point, that George has talked about. And those are done only for very, very serious diseases, like cancer that can't be treated in any other way, and that, or pediatric leukemia that can't be treated in any other way, or devastating diseases of heredity that can't be treated any other way. The gene is transmitted usually via a virus, so the person gets infected with a new genetic sequence, and it's expressed transiently to cope with this immediate disease. It's not anywhere close to the kind of radical whole genome intervention that this project might promise. So when George says, whose work I respect a lot, says he's just putting something in the cells, a new genetic map in the cells, the kind of cells that he's talking about in the science paper were iPS cells. And those are not just any old cells. Those are cells that have been changed chemically to look and act just like human embryonic stem cells, capable of differentiating into any cell in the human body. And when you have those new DNA in those kind of cells, then it's very close, it's very tempting to think about what would happen if you aggregated those cells and you began on the road to human development. That process has already happened in mice. If you aggregate the iPS or human embryonic stem cells of mice, you can create a whole mouse, right? If you make an embryo and you insert it into a mom mouse and she becomes pregnant. So the reason this is a startling kind of turn in science is because it's very close to other areas of science where we have serious ethical problems. We have significant ethical and theological problems. So in the science paper, it would have been more comforting, for instance, for those of us who were wary about this turn, to say in no way would we ever use this to make human beings. We want to talk about the science, we want to study this idea, but we want to say at the very beginning, there's a bright line between exploring this idea and ever using it to make human people, human beings. We did that when we thought about cloning. There's a bright line there. And we did that when we talked about human genetic medicine. That's a bright line about germline intervention. And that's those bright lines that prohibit certain activities of science are set up after years of discussion to constrain science and to make it operate a little more slowly, a little more publicly, with a little bit more humility.
Okay, we just have a moment before we need to go to a break, but let me ask you this. Are you mainly concerned, or are you particularly concerned, because there are commercial people involved in this, do you think there's going to be commercial pressure to do this sooner rather than later before all of these issues have been resolved?
I would be happier if this was a project of our National Institutes of Health, where there's clear oversight by bioethics and there's clear and thoughtful reflection around from a wide range of scientists. It is somewhat disturbing that the main action for this and the main impulse for this is from entrepreneurs and people who actually who believe very deeply that this is an important product needed for a human future. As soon as you create this in the lab, it doesn't belong to anyone except for the people who make it. It's a constructed entity that can then be bought and sold and exchanged in an open market. And we've seen how that kind of open market exchange distorts the essential justice and necessities of healthcare.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation. We'll come back, hear more from George Church and how he responds to what we've just heard from Laurie Zoloth. First, however, we need to take a very brief break on our program. A bit later, we'll hear that Russia's track and field team has now been banned from the Rio Olympics. They're planning to appeal. We'll hear all about that on To the Point from PRI.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Talk today about the prospect of creating a synthetic human being. We heard earlier from Lori Zoloth at Northwestern University, who is an advisor to the Genetic Literacy Project. John Entine is, in fact, the executive director of that project. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit group, promotes education about biotechnology issues. He's also author of Let Them Eat Precaution, How Politics is Undermining the Genetic Revolution in Agriculture. John Entine, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Where do you come down on this issue of the appropriateness? I don't know what the right word would be here about the whether the effort to develop a synthetic human genome is in fact moving too fast.
Well, I think the point must be underscored about how this meeting has been wildly overstated and exaggerated and misrepresented by the press. And as much as I respect Lori Zoloth in so many ways, I think there was a strain of hyperbole in the way she's characterized this. This was a meeting of 150 people. This is not a cabal of five corporate executives in an underground bunker in Washington, D.C. A lot of people knew about this meeting. We're talking about a technology that is in its infancy, that, as I think George underscored, this is somatic cell lines we're talking about. We're not talking about this crossing this red line of human germline cells, which we've frankly already crossed to some degree in gene therapy. So, a lot of these debates have happened. This debate will evolve over many, many years. What has disturbed me, and I actually saw it in Lori's public statement about this, is a sense that we should kind of stop research until we have an open and ethical consensus on these things. That has been the position of a lot of so-called bioethicists on this, NGO groups like Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace and the ETC group. There's an organization, I think of them quite radical, called the Center for Genetics and Society, and they liken this to a corporate cabal meeting to, change the human genome. Look, this is a scientific process that'll take many, many years, decades. Science needs to proceed with an open discussion about the ethical implications of that. That's what these people said at this meeting. They endorsed diverse stakeholder consultation. Let's do that, but let's not try to create the sense that there's some monster waiting in the wings to be created by man, and let's not talk about, drawing red lines when we're talking about science. These are open consultations, and I think this, my concern is that we've taken a number of technologies, like genetic engineering and agriculture is a good example, where we've scared people and polarized people because there's a fear of the technology itself. We're regulating the process rather than the products of these kinds of technologies. In this case, let's not say that this kind of research should be banned or tightly restricted until we actually know what we're talking about. We've strangled some other technologies. I hope we don't do it in this case.
Let me go back to George Church, the professor of genetics, Harvard Medical School, one of the organizers of the Synthetic Human Genome Project. How do you feel about red lines? And is it, in fact, are the ultimately, maybe it's years ahead, but ultimately, is there some truth to the idea or moral force behind the idea that Lori Zoloth raises that you want to make very sure that this technology is not used for such purposes as creating human beings, whether you call them monsters or not? Particularly, how do you speak or how do you react to that when you, in fact, have said that ultimately that's what we ought to do?
Well, I haven't said we ought to do it. I think I said we ought to consider it the same way Lori
has said
that we ought to consider it. I think I'm very much aligned with her in the importance of talking about bioethical issues long in advance of when they actually happen, because sometimes they happen very quickly. So, for example, we brought down the cost of reading DNA should have taken 6 decades. Instead, it took on the order of 6 years. So sometimes these things happen quickly. So I concur with that point of view. I certainly agree with John that that stopping research sounds a little odd. In this case, and Lori wanted it to be NIH-funded. This, we essentially, our laboratory is NIH-funded. We have a large NIH research fund for developing exactly the technology we're talking about here of synthesizing and replacing large pieces of DNA in cell lines. And I think there is a value to healthcare to be able to produce pharmaceuticals, vaccines, and a variety of other biomaterials in mammalian cells that are resistant to viruses. And there's a risk of doing any kind of stem cell therapy without some safeguards like that. So, I think that there's some clear applications today for this kind of technology. Plus, there's the research where we want to figure out when we sequence your genome and we find 3 million differences between you and the reference, which of those are likely to be actionable and which ones are not. And this ability to greatly reduce the cost of synthesis will allow us to get at cause and effect of all that unknown material. Slightly disagree with her point that this is a decade off. I mean, we can already write human DNA and are doing that. She's correct that a lot of this goes through the RAC or the FDA, and there is one that is approved. It's already fully approved, but there are many that are already curing people. But those are therapies. I mean, there also are uses for the cell lines without therapies. So I think it's happening today, and we should keep talking about it.
Thank you for correcting me when I said you had said we ought to do this. That's not what you've said, and I appreciate your clarifying that. I think it's very important. John Entine, back to you. You have said that a synthetic human genome is going to happen. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, again, we're talking about incremental steps towards the uses of synthetic biology in understanding how humans work. I think that over time, perhaps decades in advance, we're going to have aspects of human biology recreated by synthetic biology. There's no question about it.
Well, George Church suggests that it might happen sooner rather than later.
Well, aspects of it, of course. And, I mean, the somatic cell line research is keen in that. But we're talking about, if you're referring to a complete human synthetic human being, I don't know if that's a reality or not. I guess what I was trying to underscore is that the process of applying this technology is going to advance. It's whether it advances in an open society like the United States, Europe, and other Western countries, or whether it advances in a more secretive environment, perhaps in China or elsewhere, it's going to advance. I'd much rather the debate happen in an open forum in Western countries where the governments are involved in some kind of regulatory framework. But let's not be naive. There's so many potential applications here for disease amelioration that this is inevitable. It's going to happen. And I'd rather it be in the hands of someone like George Church with ethical input from people like Lori than us putting a stop to this because of red lines that we're drawing and have it occur in other places where regulatory oversight is much more minimal.
Let me go back to our first guest, Antonio Regalado, with the MIT Technology Review. Do you agree that this has been exaggerated in the press and sensationalized?
I think that the possibility of synthetic people, to George Church's point, is kind of unlikely. I mean, we had a debate over cloning, and there was Time magazine covers, and everybody was worried about human cloning. And in fact, cloning has become commonplace. You can go to an agricultural catalog, and you can order cloned cow embryos, and you can have a cloned cow. We eat cloned cows, so cloning has become mainstream, but there are no cloned people. So it's just as simple as having an agency like the FDA, which has safety rules, to draw what is a bright line between what you should and what you shouldn't do. So
could we have cloned people if, in fact, somebody chose to do that?
I think absolutely. There would be no reason that cloning wouldn't work in humans, as far as people know.
So, Laurie Zoloth, back to you. Are you reassured by the fact that there haven't been any cloned people, even though we have the capacity to do that? You said you have great respect for George Church. And what do you say to John Entine, who says, let's not stop before we manage to explore some of the extraordinary benefits that this technology might bring?
Well, the reason why it's interesting to think about science in this way, and I'm a strong supporter of science, as John and Antonio and George all know. I'm someone who wants them to go ahead. I want them to fully explore human possibilities. But I do think we need a discussion about the nature, goal, and meaning of this scientific project. We need to decide, A, if there's something in principle wrong with going ahead with making synthetic human DNA. We need to decide for what purposes and what applications would be considered just and ethical. We need to consider how the goods of this science would be regulated and fairly shared. And we need to decide how it is you'd regulate the rules that you would set up. Because, of course, everything can't be permitted in science. Everything has to be thought through and carefully. We have to ask every question, is this the right act and what makes it so? And that's why George has long said you have to think about bioethical issues long in advance of their scientific probabilities. And he's been actually a leader in that discussion in the field of synthetic biology. So what I'm calling for is to broaden the discussion at the very beginning. Is this the right act and what makes it so? And so, yes, many things could be studied. Many things could be funded. I'm fully in favor of supporting the construction of longer genomes that are now currently possible, to think about plants and animals. The kind of plants that we're going to need in a catastrophically warming world are going to be very different from the plants that currently grow. And so some of those projects I think we should start with. And we can wait and to see if any possible applications would be possible using human DNA.
George Church, the question has been raised that there may be others who are not as concerned about the red lines or whatever you want to call them as you are. Are you aware of any other projects that are moving forward, whether they be in China or Russia or other places where they might have the technology to do it?
I think that, yes, I think that this is a global effort. I think a lot of the innovation is in fairly small number of labs that are well known. I don't see big pockets where you have an intersection of high innovation and lax regulation. I think, fortunately, most of the places that are highly innovative are also highly regulated, which kind of argues against the boogeyman of overregulation. I actually think China's quite good at this. You know, when they wanted to, they shut down genetics and brought it genome reading and brought it back up in a very disciplined way. So I think we should stop the China bashing. But overall, I mean, it is possible, and we need to guard against it. And one of the things I pointed out since 2004 is it's not sufficient for us all to sign on to the moratorium. What we need is surveillance. We need strong surveillance to make sure that worldwide that this is happening.
How do we make sure, though? You say strong surveillance might do it, but do we have international protocols? Are there ways to exert influence on other people in other places that might, in fact, want to move ahead more quickly and create what was referred earlier as a monster?
I think we have some amazing progress in that direction, and we could really take it another notch up. So in 2004, I suggested surveillance in the form of software that could look through all of the synthesis that's done worldwide. In 2004, there was some resistance to that because there was concern from lawyers of some of the synthesis companies. But since then, that has now become quite commonplace. Most of the major synthesis houses have a policy in place, and they share some of their software for doing this. I think that could be made international law, so that literally everything is available for surveillance.
What do you do about the commercial pressures? You yourself are co-founder and shareholder of a couple of companies that might benefit from all of this. Others are you're looking for investment, and people want to see something for their money. Do you think that commerce and industry are liable to push this forward more quickly than it ought to go?
The companies that I work with are very responsive to FDA. I mean, they know that their survival depends on it. In fact, I'm more worried about this. Often comes up, and I'm more worried about a radical tenured professor who has essentially no stake in the game, nothing to lose, doing something funny or sad. Rather than a corporation that has to report every bad public relations event to its stockholders. I'm not saying you should ignore it, but I think we need laws in place, the same thing that Antonio said. We just decide what we do and don't want to do, and we don't ban all research on jets just because jets can be used as weapons.
So, Laurie Zoloth, is it a good thing that this leak did occur and that we are now raising these issues? Are you reassured by what we've heard from our other guests?
I'm in a long conversation with the three men who are here about this, and I am reassured. I do think that, Warren, you've played a real role in allowing people to think this through, and this is the beginning of this kind of larger public discourse that I keep calling for. One thing that we haven't mentioned, but it's important, when we talk about this technology spreading and the fear that people would, you know, use this to create people, is you still need a woman to give birth to a baby, right? And that the women all around the world actually have tremendous concern for their children, and this is not a commodified act in most cases. So I am sure that the rules, the regulations, the protections for human subject research, and the general love that women have for their babies would prevent any sort of monstrous activity from happening. And that's one of the things that has to be brought in here.
All right. We are out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. And Laurie Zoloth, thank you very much, professor of religion and bioethics at Northwestern University. Thanks to John Entine at the Genetic Literacy Project, author of Let Them Eat Precaution, How Politics is Undermining the Genetic Revolution in Agriculture. Thanks, of course, to George Church, professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School, and Antonio Regalado with the MIT Technology Review. We'll come back to this as time goes on, as will so many others. And thank you for giving us a real head start in the conversation. The worst fears of Russia's track and field team have been realized. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Warren Olney back with today's talking point. The governing body of World Track and Field, the IAAF, announced today that the ban against Russian track and field athletes will be extended to this summer's Olympics in Rio. Here's the former world record miler, Sebastian Coe, who is now IAAF president.
Although good progress has been made, the IAAF Council was unanimous that RUSAF had not met the reinstatement conditions and that Russian athletes could not credibly return to international competition without undermining the confidence of their competitors and the public.
Dick Pound is with us, founding president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, called WADA. He headed the investigation into what he called at the time a deeply rooted culture of cheating at all levels. Dick Pound, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
How important is it that this decision was unanimous?
I think pretty important. You don't want to have something that goes to the credibility of your sport decided, 12 to 11 with three abstentions or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I think all of them sitting around the table said, look, we have to speak with a single voice on this issue. It's far too important not to.
Is this the decision you hoped for?
Yes. I mean, certainly based on what our commission had found, and the subsequent reports by the German television reporter and WADA itself with respect to the just getting access to Russian athletes for testing purposes, it's pretty clear that most of the talk was just talk.
Just describe, if you will, for listeners who are not up to speed, what happened, what the Russians are accused of having done over a long period of time and in a very well-organized way.
Yeah, basically, it went from intimidating the doping control officers that were coming to test the athletes, giving advance notice of tests that are supposed to be no advance notice, changing samples remove suspicious samples by protected athletes and replacing them with others, using false identities, prescribing and administering doping programs for athletes. It was just throughout from top to bottom, and all under the watchful eye of the state.
The state meaning Russia.
Yes.
Russia says it will appeal. It's outraged about this. It says it will appeal to the